we're reinvigorated. Like I'm happy to come to work. I'm not stressed. I can sleep at night. I know that my margins are right. I know that there's money in the bank. I know the customers are happy. The staff are happy. Like it's kind of, it doesn't get better than that. Because going to work when you know that you are going broke, which is what every person who runs a restaurant probably feels all the time, it's just too hard to do for too long.
This week on Dirty Linen, we continue to talk staffing, but with a different skew today. We're looking at the impacts of the pandemic on hospitality business models, asking what kinds of tweaks and wholesale rethinks have people made to craft businesses that are more viable, maybe more fun, sometimes simply feasible, and perhaps just better aligned with their hearts, souls, and visions for a balanced life. We're starting in Kyneton with sometime publican Melissa McFarlane, who with her husband Frank Moylan caused a tasty stir with the Farmers Arms in Daylesford, then the Royal George in Kyneton. They also ran the Crimean in North Melbourne after a hiatus in Bulgaria. Melissa hates to see an empty glass, and I'm delighted to welcome her to the show. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's so good to have you here. So COVID brought obviously a lot of changes for a lot of people in all kinds of different ways. Give us a little overview of your businesses at the beginning of COVID, and then let's talk about what's happened with them.
Okay, so I had two businesses in two different industries. So I've had a vintage furniture, sort of homewares business for 11 years. And I did it after I thought I was never going back to hospitality. And so then we had to take back the hotel in 2019, which was unexpected. So I'm sort of running two businesses at the same time, which was exhausting, and I wasn't very good at either of them. And so then COVID happened and I shut everything down and took a big break and did a lot of thinking. And so I moved my furniture business into the hotel, which we have had for many years, and that kind of strangely made sense. Then once I'd sort of recovered from that and had done all the thinking, I thought, let's do we have a general license, let's do a bottle shop, and maybe we'll just be specialized in vermouth, amari and bitters, the sort of backbone of cocktails that I like. And then we tried to put plants in there with it that maybe went back to the alcohol, but that was kind of impossible in COVID. So it basically became a bottle shop and a plant shop. And that kind of took off. It made sense to people. And so that's where everything changed for us. So the bottle shop was a necessity to, service loans and stuff like that. And then something grew from that.
Wow, it's so interesting because I think, when I think about a pub, I really just think about a pub and all the, I suppose you can have lots of different food offerings, accommodation offerings, band offerings within a pub. But, yeah, a plant shop and a furniture shop, I just don't think I've ever heard of that in a pub building.
No, well, I mean, the pub, I mean, I love pubs. Obviously, this is our fourth attempt at one. But they're sort of so fixed in, what they can be. And so if you think about all the country hotels around Victoria that are all for sale, by the way, how can they become something else? And they often got chopped in half and one became, for example, a furniture store. It might, in the case of this hotel, there was a hairdresser in it. So they kind of were divided up. And so from that point, I thought, okay, well, it is okay to do that. I just don't have a physical wall in between what is hospitality and what is furniture. So that's how I kind of, could sort of arrive at that and feel comfortable that it wasn't, the craziest idea ever.
Yeah, but sure. So in just backtracking to 2019, you said you took the pub back. What was the situation there? Because you own the building, don't you?
Yeah. And so the tenants went bankrupt. They, you know, they surrendered their lease and we had to take it back. And at that stage, it wasn't worth anything because it couldn't sustain a business. And hotels are only worth what business can exist in it, so in the country. You know, the city or hotel can be worth its land and someone can develop it and turn it into apartments, but in the country it's only worth what rent it can generate. And if it can't sustain a business, then the rent must drop. Unless you want a tenant for 3 months, you know, and we always wanted a tenant that could survive. So it sort of became, you know, we had to take it back, fix it up, and so we started a little sort of, you know, a gastropub model, something for the locals, something fun. And we did that for a year and it was okay. But there was that, you know, that recession coming before COVID. So we sort of downsized anyway and started thinking seriously before our hands were forced.
Mm. It's so interesting that you talk about this pre-COVID recession. I mean, is that where staff were hard to come by? That sort of long boom had seemed like it was tailing off.
I think other restaurateurs you speak to kind of talk about like the average spend going down around then, that people aren't going on all the rides when they go out for dinner. They're just maybe confining it to a main and one bottle of wine. Staffing's always a challenge in the country, like always. You know that that's going to be your long-term problem. But for us it was that just the average spend wasn't there, that tourists weren't visiting Kyneton, you know, and Kyneton doesn't have many overnight stays like Daylesford, for example. So I think that there's only 200 beds in Kyneton. So the tourist offering, you know, is important, but split across, and we've got some really good restaurants here, like split across those restaurants, there's not many. Yeah. So it was about average spend for us.
And so as you put in the plants and you put in the bottle shop and then you've also added a bar, can you sort of talk about what the offering is at the moment?
Okay, so it's a two-story hotel. Downstairs is pretty much all the furniture, but the furniture is glassware and textiles and, you know, objects. And then you walk upstairs and then upstairs is a continuation of retail, but in that there is a bottle shop and we've got like 140 now vermouth, bitters, Amari. So getting a pretty substantial collection. And then we have a fragrance counter as well, because of course you would. And then you walk into this cocktail bar, and so you can be sort of, the idea is I want it to be like a department store where you're wandering around and go, oh, that's nice. And, oh, that's nice. And hold on, I can have a cocktail as well. So it's that sense of discovery. And then so we have the bottle shop and you walk into the bar, and so there is a pretty substantial list of all the – so you can buy every single one of the Amari – bitters and vermouths to take home, or you can have it in-house, or you can build your own sort of cocktails with it. And then we do, and from a food point of view, it is, you know, beautiful cheese, local charcuterie, pâté, you know, those kind of day drinking snacks. And that's pretty much it.
And so you don't need a chef?
Nope.
And you can have a drink and wander around and look at the furniture, et cetera?
Yeah, you can in the day, but at night we sort of close down the furniture because people, you know, have more than one drink.
Start really testing things out.
Exactly. We've also got a bed up there because we sell bed heads and bed linen, and we have found people in the bed at night.
Who did you find in the bed? Were they asleep? What state were they in?
They had several cocktails. Yeah.
Interesting. This is R-rated, by the way. Oh, not officially, but we've had people say all kinds of things on this podcast. Okay, so how are you feeling about your businesses?
Well, I'm feeling incredibly privileged and lucky that I have been able to, because I had two strings that, though it was stressful at the time, I've been able to merge them. And, you know, I'm really sort of lucky that I've been able to do that. And, you know, we have this old hotel that, you know, had, you know, in 2020 was looking like a white elephant. So I'm, we're reinvigorated. Like I'm happy to come to work. I'm not stressed. I can sleep at night. I know that my margins are right. I know that there's money in the bank. I know the customers are happy. The staff are happy. Like, it's kind of, it doesn't get better than that. Because going to work when you know that you are going broke, which is what every person who runs a restaurant probably feels all the time, it's just too hard to do for too long.
I mean, I do think about you in that period of 2019 when you'd taken back the pub in circumstances that weren't of your choosing. You'd sort of cranked up the gastropub offering. I mean, what was that feeling like?
It had a sense of obligation to it, and, you know, we kind of didn't really enjoy it. It wasn't our choosing. And, you know, we had stopped doing hospitality, so to turn back on your interests was really hard. But COVID gave us the opportunity to kind of stop and go, okay, if we're going to do it, let's just do stuff that we really love and are interested in. And so we've done that, and it works, and it's better for our mental health.
Because, I mean, I only know you guys through being in venues that you've run, and I would say that you have always seemed to create such a sense of hospitality, like that you're real believers in the art of hospitality. So it's really interesting to sort of hear about, you know, you sort of feeling like you'd left it and you've been able to re-enter that world with a different skew. But I mean, how does that sit with you? Do you sort of believe in hospitality? Did you just fall out of love with it? I mean, you know, what are those pressures there?
So I think that we will always, hospitality to us is a calling. We're people pleasers, so we're not necessarily always looking at the bottom line and margin like proper business people do, because we just love, you know, creating spaces that people have fun in. But then if that's not working, you know, financially, you can't do it for too long. But saying that, I still think that we're in hospitality, even though it's 90%, or let's say 80% retail and 20% hospitality, we still see that we're in hospitality. Because we're, you know, hospitality is a bottle shop still, isn't it? If you, you know, it doesn't have to just be about food. It's about reading people and, you know, telling them a story and introducing them to something new and showing them, you know, alternatives.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd also say that you could probably put a hospitality lens on perfume and furniture.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, exactly. It's customer service. But we're in the country, so there's a little bit of tourism in there as well, so you kind of have to do a bit more storytelling than maybe that you do in the city.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we love our version of hospitality at the moment.
Mm, that's so great. And from a staffing point of view, can you just talk about, you know, what that has been like and what it's like at the moment?
So because the margin in retail is better than the margin in food, from a cost point of view, it is great compared to running you know, like a middle of the range kind of restaurant. Staffing it, like finding people, we have been blessed.
Wow.
Sorry. Sorry to all the people that aren't. But because we're offering something that's not so, doesn't exhaust you so much, we only trade late two nights a week. There's people that want to work for us because there's other things that they can do. It's not just, you know, taking plates to tables and polishing cutlery. You know, it's got a little bit more to it. So, you know, we need one more person for us to go 7 days, which is incredible. But yeah, we've been blessed. And I know that other people haven't, but I think it's because there's a balance in there for the workload and there's other things to be done and to get excited about at work.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know that so many hospitality people have had that opportunity to reflect on work-life balance through COVID, and a lot of people have come out the other side saying, nah, I'm just not going to do those hours anymore. So I think businesses that are able to meet those new decisions, those new modes of being, are certainly at an advantage.
Yeah, I mean, and so some of the owners of businesses would probably go, you know what, I don't want to do that either. And, you know, so we're only trading late till an hour late's 10 p.m., like that's it, you know. So, yeah, so much has changed. But I wonder what will happen in, say, 3 months' time, 6 months' time, when the realities of employment might kick in a little bit more and people will come back to it, but they've had a break for a year. So yeah, I don't know. I don't know the answer to that one.
Melissa, how did you get into the industry?
I met Frank and he had a bar, and then I said, well, you know, we should open our own. And we went to Adelaide to open a bar, and we were young and, you know, foolish, and yeah, just been hooked on it ever since. But because I'm an interior designer as well, I love creating the space and, you know, creating an experience, I suppose.
Interesting.
So I didn't go to school, or I wasn't a chef or any, you know, anything like that. It was just like, I like having people around to my house. Oh, that'd be a good idea. Why don't you open a bar? Which it wasn't. Anyway, that's, yeah, or I was born to it.
Must have been. So I remember when you opened the Farmer's Arms in Daylesford, and it really just did feel like a bit of a new burst of energy and possibility for a country pub. When was that actually that you started or took that pub on and made it what it was?
It was the first day of GST, so July 1st, 2000. And of course, being people pleasers and not financially savvy, we didn't put the GST up 10% on the first day that we should have. Yeah, we didn't put the price up, the 10%. We just went, people won't pay that for a beer. And, like, that wasn't our choice, but we just took it all on, you know. We were babies. Our learning curve was very steep, and we probably didn't know what we were doing for 4 years, I'd say, truthfully. But, you know, we thought it would take us years to do anyway, but it was Daylesford and, you know, it was a good time. There were possibilities about what could happen in the regions. There was that whole regional food tourism stuff that was happening, you know, the symposiums and stuff like that we went to, and there was a lot of talk about the possibilities of what things could be like in the country, which we now take for granted. But before that, you couldn't, you know, there wasn't even coffee machines.
Yeah, it was definitely felt, I mean, obviously Lakehouse and Alla and the team there had done so much for Daylesford and for regional tourism in Victoria and Australia generally, but I feel like the Farmers Arms really gave the whole scene a real kick along with a different kind of offering.
I had no idea.
Really? Oh,
yeah. It does seem like really hard work.
Oh my God, I bet it did. Yeah, it's so interesting. Its perspective is so interesting, isn't it? Because for me, it was just like, wow, this is so good. It feels like being in the country, but it's got a bit of that city polish and this very, you know, great produce, but quite simple. And yeah, I just loved it. I thought the hospitality there was brilliant.
Well, thank you.
So, Melissa, I've heard that you guys have a house in Bulgaria, that you've spent a bit of time there. I'm curious about this Bulgarian connection because I've got a bit of a Bulgarian connection myself, but you tell me yours first.
Okay, so we had basically done, 6 years at the Farmers Arms and 3 years at the Royal George and had no holiday. So we went on a holiday. So let's say 10 years, and we went on a holiday, and when we came back, we fell into that post-European holiday depression. And then started Googling, you know, and it was just people were buying houses in the recently joined EU countries for hardly anything. And we just started this sort of, you know, deep dive on, and we found BulgarianProperties.com and then just went in and, you know, found all these incredible houses for hardly any money. And we just kept going and going and going. And then I said to my mum, that's it. I'm going to Bulgaria to buy a house. And she said, I'm coming with you. And so my dad would have, he just thought it was like an absolute folly. Anyway, so we went. Oh, just before we went, we got a call from the agent saying, would we be prepared to be the subject of a documentary series of people buying houses? And the program was called The New Bulgarians. And we went, sure, we'll do that. So we arrive and there's camera, there's like a whole team, production team, you know, cars, cameras, microphones. And anyway, so we kind of got swept up in it. And then we had this moment where we looked at some houses and it is frontier Bulgaria. It is beautiful, but it is the frontier. And my mum just said, you know, we've only got one life, let's do it. So we did it. And then we went back another time and they did another little, you know, episode about us and we got it renovated. And then, so we probably went 4 times in 3 years and I love it, but then life's gotten in the way and we haven't been back.
And is there people in it in the meantime?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's so amazing.
I know, but we don't know them and we probably don't, you know, we probably may not even own it, but it didn't cost much and it brought us around to having the Crimean, which, you know, was, you know, I feel proud of that restaurant because it moved so many people. Like people would cry in there, which is, you know, really unexpected.
Because it had that real Eastern European
heart
and soul and, yeah, I guess different wines that people hadn't drunk and some of that real good old Middle European food.
And more like with the music, we'd often play like 60s pop from, you know, from the Czech Republic or Hungary and their guy sat at the bar and ate goulash and wept, you know, one night. And like we had a Georgian choir like pop up in the restaurant, which was amazing. And then because those countries, their food wasn't represented in Melbourne, you know, in that way. And so a lot of people would come in there and get kind of touched. It was incredible.
It was really special. So my Bulgarian connection is that when I was a kid, my mum would talk about this time when she was a Thomas Cook travel guide, and she spent summers all around the place, but she spent a summer in Bulgaria at Zlatni Piazhchi, which I'm probably saying wrong, but it means golden sands, and it's a resort on the Black Sea. So she looked after people there. And then when I was travel writing for Lonely Planet, that was the first overseas destination that I was sent, because I think they thought, well, she can't do too much wrong with the Bulgarian part of the Eastern European travel guide. So I traveled around Bulgaria by myself for a couple of months researching that, and it was very post-Soviet. And like the corruption was so much part of life that the various mafias would advertise on bus stops for their protection services. And there was... Yeah, I went to Golden Sands, the resort where my mum had worked, and it was basically...
Oh, my God, that would have been incredible.
It was an absolute ghost town with, like, gunshots in walls, and it was around Easter time. It was freezing cold, and I remember somehow on a dare I met some people, and I leapt into the Black Sea on a very cold April day. And live to tell the tale. But I feel like I've never been so cold, shockingly, you know, that shocking cold. It just completely takes your breath away. But I loved it. And my dad's Slovak, and I've got Hungarian grandmothers, and my family's Jewish, so it's kind of different to the Bulgarian history. But I definitely, when I was learning bits of Bulgarian, I felt a little bit like I was remembering it from some deep part of myself within. So, I'll pop by your house in Bulgaria one day and check who really owns it.
Yeah, the town that it's in has now, somebody has gone there, and it's called Staro Jelizare Art Town. And this woman has got, like, mural artists from all over Europe to come and replicate masters on all the walls in the town. It's fascinating, and it changes every year. And they did, like, classic sort of, you know, Renaissance painting. And then somebody came in and did, like, Andy Warhol, or even Rothko and stuff like that, all over the walls of this town. And people travel there to – it's – yeah. So I'm hoping somebody's gone in there and done something incredible to our house.
Wow, it sounds amazing. And when we can travel again, I might put it on the itinerary.
Yeah, we plan to go back to that. That'd be great to see it. Yeah, so now it's a tourist destination of its own. So people just go to this town, yeah.
So the new Bulgarians might have made a canny investment back in
Maybe.
The day.
Maybe. That one is pure luck.
Melissa, it's really fantastic to have a chat to you. Let's finish by you just telling me why it is that you love the vermouth and the Amari, all those parts of the drinking dictionary.
I suppose it's because I find it fascinating, the history, but mostly because you know that Made and I, vermouth, Gilles lives up here. So he's the guy that kind of catapulted the whole vermouth culture in Australia, you know, to kind of, you know, what it is now. And it's just, I just find it fascinating, like, just eat flavour profiles, building it into drinks, I don't know, it's kind of a bit more exciting than wine. I'm sorry to say it to all the people that love wine and the winemakers that I know. There's just a lot more going on, and you can play around with it a little bit. You can be more creative. I mean, I know that people do blend wine at home, but do you know what I mean? Like, you can start sort of making your own drinks, I suppose. So that part's fascinating. And then there's how long people have been doing it in Italy, France and Spain, and then just building great drinks. So, you know, I do still like wine, but I find this a little bit more interesting. And then I didn't know when I did it that so do a lot of other people. Like, it's a little bit nerdy. Like, I never set out to have a thing that, you know, people just get right into, but they do. And it's fantastic.
It is so great. I mean, it's I love all the different businesses and different SKUs on the world of hospitality people are able to come up with. Some of them, you know, you sort of been shoehorned into or circumstances have taken you there, and sometimes it's just, you know, it's the bolt of inspiration, you just have to do it. And I suppose yours has been a bit of both. It's a bit of fortune, but a bit of thinking time during that funny old year we had last year. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us, Melissa. It was really fantastic to talk to you. And, yep, I look forward to seeing you and Frank in kind for an interesting drink and a little sneaky lie down in the bed. No, don't worry, I won't do that.
No, that we do have other beds that you can hire around the town. But, yeah, catch the train up and then you can do your hashtag day drinking and then go all the way back.
Sounds awesome. Okay, take care.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
This is Dirty Linen and I'm Danny Vallant. We air the issues that the hospitality industry finds hard to talk about. We spend a week thrashing around each issue, hearing from different people with unique perspectives. We want to hear from you as well. If you have something that needs to be said about a topic, get in touch so we can include your perspective. Contact us at dirtylinen@deepintheweeds.com.au or hit us up on Insta @dirtylinenpodcast. We can't wait to hear from you. This.